We have the red light blinking. Excellent. We are up to chapter 25, Chanukah Sameach. If I can say Sameach in a Neo class, you know. We're on page 1653 for those using the green art scroll Tanakh. And yes, we should exceed one chapter today. Those who have looked at chapter 25 will understand what I'm talking about. Someone seems to have run out of things to say, it looks like. This is Bildad's third and last speech. It is the last speech from any of the visitors. This concludes their words, and then in 26 we'll get Job's response, which also is, you know, pretty brief by his standards. And then that will sort of clear the decks to be able to see Job present his sort of valedictory comments, you know, sort of, summing up a little. Well, we'll see it. But we'll get his final remarks, and that will lead into the fourth visitor, a fellow by the name of Elihu, who takes a different tack and who presents a whole new set of problems. So we are in chapter 25. Does everyone have sheets? I don't know if we're out at this point. I did leave some on the end table. Okay. So Bildad, remember, believes in divine justice, like Eliphaz, who spoke first. He's more subtle sometimes than Bildad in his understanding of what justice is. Sometimes what looks bad is actually good. Sometimes people generate their own suffering. It's not God doing it to them as much as people ruining things for themselves. And so in his first speech, Bildad said, he seemed to have indicated that Job has sinned and his children have sinned. That wasn't subtle. He talked about divine justice. He said those who abandon God collapse like a reed without water, but things can end well. Remember, he had two parables. One was the reed and one was the tree that is removed from one place and then is planted again elsewhere and it flourishes there. And the possibility was to see in there a message of hope that maybe that which seems bad isn't really bad. It's just temporarily so, and then eventually it will improve. To which Job responded by saying that he really wants to sue God, and I think that was really the first time we saw the attempt to draw God into litigation. He said the world is run unjustly, and he offers his tirade of challenges to God. When we got to the second round, Bildad said, wicked people suffer, they do it to themselves, they lose everything, home, family, skin, which seemed to be a hint at Job. Job, this is what you are suffering because you're one of them. To which Job replied that Bildad is being unjust, and Bildad takes Job's isolation as a sign of his guilt. And Job said, I see my isolation as a sign of your disloyalty. You should have been on my side. You should have been with me. Something he also said to Eliphaz. And then he said, in a very interesting ending to chapter 19, he said, there will be justice. And justice is going to punish my visitors. It's going to punish all those people who were disloyal. Those are the ones who have no future. And remember, there we had this, it was a very interesting passage. It seemed to speak of some kind of an ultimate divine justice to be carried out, and even, you know, life after death. Like, it was a very interesting end, chapter 19. If you don't remember that, go back and take a look. It's worth it. So here we're going to get Bildad's third speech. And it seems to be a response to not what Job had said to Bildad earlier, but to what Job said to Eliphaz. So, recalling a little bit of what Job said to Eliphaz before he got to the confusing part at the end, where he seemed to be co-opting Eliphaz's message. But the section immediately before that, Job had said, God is going to acknowledge that I am right and pure, and Bildad is going to say, who are you kidding? God is all-powerful, God is all-seeing, and God is all-just. Everything is defective in God's eyes, certainly you, Job. And and human beings are nothing. There's no way God is going to find you to be righteous. That's what we're going to see him say in approximately that many sentences. This is a very short chapter. Blink and it's gone. I didn't even put an outline of it on the sheet. I chose to put sources there instead, just because it's a 6-sentence paragraph, and the first one is "and Bildad said." So I didn't really think the outline was so necessary there. But this is the last speech directed to Job by the visitors, and therefore the primary question that I want to think about as we read the chapter is, why is this so short? Like, I would have expected, if they're, you know, they're going to give us the last speech, like, this is going to be like some kind of a summary, and they're going to sort of hit on all their points, like closing argument type of a thing. But it's not. He has five sentences of speech, and they're very short.
But maybe the rhetoric that he's talking about is understood in a bigger way by those people who listen to it. Maybe this is a shorthand.
Right. So maybe what he's going to say is shorthand. Now you have to explain how that actually works as we go through it. But it's possible that this is a shorthand. Maybe he believes that in five sentences he has actually captured everything he's been trying to say all along, everything, all of them. Maybe. It's a possibility. But again, you're going to have to show me how it fits. So I'm going to come back to you. Alina.
Okay, maybe it's proof that somebody can explain that maybe the beginning of the speech, because it's so short. I don't know if it really flows, because I haven't read what he's saying. But
right. And that's the argument that they bring. When those who take the side of amending the text say, well, Bildad is so short here because this was lifted out of Bildad's speech. That originally it was Bildad's speech, and then it got extracted from there. But again, there are weaknesses in doing it. Textually, it doesn't seem to fit. And thematically, it doesn't seem to fit. It's hard to pitch that. But yes, that would be, you know, it's sort of like when you look at a map of the globe and say, well, this continent would fit with that continent. So Pangaea, they were all one continent originally. Like, that's the sort of thing. Like, well, this would fit because now Bildad would be longer. And we would take that nuisance out of Job's speech, which doesn't really seem to fit his. So that is, in fact, the appeal of it. And along with the fact that we're going to see in chapter 27, Job is again going to seem to co-opt their approach. And so they'll say, well, that was actually Zophar's speech, because Zophar is gone entirely from this round. Now, again, it won't work so well, but that's an approach. So let's jump into this and see chapter 25. Again, it's page 1653, if you're using the Stone Tanakh. Vayan Bildad HaShuchi Vayomar. Bildad the Shuchite spoke up and he said, Hamshel v'fachad imo oseh shalom bimromav. Sound familiar? That's where it comes from. The line, oseh shalom bimromav, hu yaseh shalom aleh, oseh shalom bimromav, is from Job. I told you that when we started this year. All the great lines out of liturgy are Jobian. Of all the places in the world, that's where they dug to find things. Go figure. But hamshel v'fachad imo, dominion, and I translate it as intimidation. What do they do here for pachad? That's the way dread. Okay, dread. That's not bad. Dominion and dread. It sounds better that way, I admit. The alliteration is good. But dominion and dread are with him. Oseh shalom bimromav. He makes peace in his heavens. And I'm going to read the next sentence because it goes with it. Hayesh mispar ligdudav. Is there a number? Can you put a number to all of his forces, all of the entities at his disposal? V'almi lo yakum orehu. And where does his light not shine? His light is everywhere, meaning he is?
Everywhere.
Well, not just that he is everywhere, he is all-seeing. The idea of his light is that he illuminates everywhere, he can see everywhere. That's the image of his light being everywhere. So what we're saying is he is all-powerful, and he is all-seeing. But there's something in this sentence too, in particular, that is very challenging. Yeah?
Al mi, it also being translated like this, is upon whom?
Correct. God sees everyone. I shouldn't say everything. It's everyone, yes. You're right. It's me in the sentence in the Hebrew. The upon whom does his light not shine? God sees everybody. True.
Everything too, but it's not.
Yeah,
also
no, that's a good point.
Everyone is, because not only on the table, at the table, but also under the table, so whatever is hidden, so he does see everything.
Right, no, but I think the point of everyone means Job as well.
Exactly.
You know.
He thinks everything is hidden, or he is hidden, and God doesn't see him.
Exactly. You think God doesn't see you. I have news for you. God's light is everywhere, on everyone. But this sentence, too, is a problem. How does the first half fit with the second half? Dominion and dread are with him is a grand intimidating clause. He makes peace in his heavens. Yeah, greeting card. How does one lead to the other?
But it's the same. Yeah. It's the same contrast in the second pasuk in three.
Yeah. How so?
Is there any number of his armies? That's the dread and dominion, and then it's a kind light shining upon him.
Oh, you're assuming the light is a kind light.
Yeah.
Not in like I see everything you can't hide from me light.
Something like that.
Maybe.
I didn't see it as negative.
Okay. Ralph, and then Rebecca. Yeah.
Well, I assume that dominion and fear refer to man's domain, and peace refers to God's domain.
So the dominion and the dread are in this world. The peace is going on up in the heavens. Things are good up there. And without applying that to sentence three, then, just in general. Okay.
Or he's in charge of everything good and bad.
Maybe. Rebecca.
I was going to follow Carla, because until you said it, I thought of light as being positive. So he makes peace on high, one thought that bring light, bring goodness.
Okay, so it's an intentional contrast. First half of the sentences is harsh, second half of the sentences is benign. Could be. Shana.
I was just going to say, these are all very benign readings. The darker reading is, because he is full of majesty and fear, therefore there is peace.
Yeah. In other words, it is the peace of the tyrant.
Yeah.
As in, no one speaking up to say to the contrary, I guess things are good. That kind of an approach. Absolutely possible, in which case the whole thing is then again very sinister. The problem is that it's Bildad talking. If Job was talking, I would say, you got it. That's exactly the read. But it's not. Now, Job has borrowed their speech, so is Bildad turning the tables and saying, I can do you also.
But also, I mean, if you're a totalitarian fan, so to speak, this is not such a disturbing passage. This is how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
That if you want order, you're going to have an enforcer. Mm-hmm. And if you want peace, you need order. Therefore, this is how you have to structure the world.
So this is a sales pitch.
Yes, I would say.
Interesting as a possibility. Okay, maybe. Maybe. Yes, Stephen.
He's saying that the dominion dread are with him, and he's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's saying peace is in his heights. That's to say peace is everywhere.
Interesting. The peace is restricted to being Bamarom in the heavens. Doesn't say he makes peace everywhere else. It's a good point. So I'll offer you a couple of thoughts, some of which mesh with what's been said. All of these ideas, I think, are good. Rashi's approach to this is to say God is just. He's just, as in fair, everywhere. And it's seen in the way that he makes peace in the heavens. And indeed, the heavens are the place where the peace actually takes place. If you take a look at source number one, I brought it on the sheets. He says, Oseh shalom bimromav, he makes peace in his heavens, kishahamazalos olim, when the constellations ascend, right? Meaning, in their march through the heavens, right? You see one constellation, then another. So, as each one ascends, kol achad sover ani ole rishon, each one thinks, I am first, lefishen oroem, mashelefanav, because it doesn't see the one who ascended previously. Right? There's only a certain number that are over the horizon. So each one thinks this is the first one to rise in the heavens. And therefore, it is not jealous. Kach shamati, so I have heard. That's one explanation that Rashi offers. God is making peace in the heavens, literally in the heavens. Because he only gives primacy to each one in its turn, and none sees the other's opportunity. Alternatively, he says, Oseh shalom bimromav, eish umayim bilulin ve'ein mayim mechabin es ha'eish. The idea is that the heavens are composed of fire and water in a mixture, going back to creation and shamayim, sham mayim, the water is way up in the heavens, and the fire is up there as well. Think of the four elements and the idea of earth and air and fire and water. So the fire is up there with it, and yet I lost the place. Ein mayim mechaben es ha'esh. Water doesn't put out the fire. God makes peace between the various elements so that they can coexist up in the heavens. And Rashi says again, yeah, I've heard that too. Now, you sort of wonder what he says, so I have heard. What exactly is he trying to say?
He's
convinced them. Yeah, unclear exactly whether he's explicitly saying, I don't know, people say this. But take a look at source number 2, which is a passage from the Talmud, which takes a similar approach. And this is about the relationship between the moon and the sun. I trust you are familiar with the Midrash about the creation of the moon, and how the moon ended up being smaller than the sun and reflecting the light of the sun, right? The Midrash goes that Hashem creates the sun and the moon to be the same size, but the moon is arrogant and it says, hey, why do we get to be equal? You can't have two kings with the same crown. And God says, you're right, I'll shrink you. Which, you know, is a nice moral and provides a nice lesson. Where is this coming from in the Psukim? Remember, we spent a year studying Midrash a couple of years ago. Where does this come from in the Psukim? Yes, Shana?
Starts with God creating two lights, and then the greater light, one of the
other lights. Right, not only does it start creating two lights, you're right, but it says, Shnei Ha'aros HaGidolim. It said God created two large luminaries, and then it says the large one to be by day, and the small one to be by night. So that's where we have a problem. Why did it say the two large ones, and then the large and the small? So you could give a simple answer and say, because relative to us, they're both large. That would be a simple read of the sentence. What the Midrash is saying is that actually God started out with them large and then decided to reduce one of them. And this reduction is taken as a lesson in humility. And there's more to be said about how it fits into the Psukim. We were studying that Midrash, I would go into it further. But the point is that the moon, following on this Midrash, will forever feel diminished, because it is. And so take a look at source number 2. This is regarding witnesses who testified to having seen the new moon. Now, remember that when the moon is new, you can't actually see it, right, in the beginning. And then gradually, you start to be able to see the crescent of the moon. And it is a crescent, which means that it has the rounded shape, and then in the middle is a gap. A defect, in other words. And that's the word that's used in the Hebrew for it, is a pigam. It's a flaw. It's a defect. So that is what we pick up on here in source number 2. Im amar lifnei achama lo amar klum. If the witness who says, I saw the new moon, it's time for the new month to begin. If the witness shows up in court and is examined by the judges, and the witness says that he saw the moon in front of the sun. And what we're suggesting here is that the way that the moon was situated was such that the curve of the moon was open and the sun was there. I mean, not literally here and here, that's not the point. But the idea is something that we know from a physics perspective can't happen, because the sun is what is shining off of the curve. So, right? We know how the moon works, right? The sun's light reflected off of the moon is what's giving you the curve. The sun will never be on the gap side of the moon. The sun will always be on the other side of the moon.
It's actually the earth.
All true. Yes. All true. I'm working with colloquialisms, and talking about the sun moving and so forth. Yes. The sun does move, but not in this regard, and you bet. So, but if the witness said, I saw the moon in front of the sun, lo amar klum, he has said nothing. Why? Well, it's because of astronomy. But he says, da'amar Rabbi Yochanan, because Rabbi Yochanan says, may dechsev hamshav afachad imo oser shalom bimramav. He quotes our verse, that God makes peace up in the heavens. What does that mean? May olam lo ra sachama pigimasa shel levana. The sun never saw the defect in the moon, meaning the sun is never in a position to see the flaw in the moon. Why? Dechal shadaita, because it would upset the moon. Not only did you shrink me and give me a flaw such that I can only reflect the sun's light, but now your sun gets to see that. It's embarrassing. Now, whether we're talking about the moon actually being embarrassed or whether we're trying to convey a lesson, which is if you have to give someone less than somebody else, or if you have to punish someone, don't do it in front of others, right? However you take this, whether it's trying to give me an ethical lesson or whether it's telling me, yeah, the moon cares, either way, that's not the point. The point is, and the reason I bring it is, because Rabbi Yochanan sees in our verse a statement that God is making peace up in the heavens. In this case, keeping the peace between the sun and the moon. You follow? That's the idea. The sun is making peace. God is making peace between the sun and the moon by ensuring that the moon will never suffer embarrassment. That's the idea. The problem I have with this, it's a nice idea in its own right. If I just have the words "Oseh Shalom Bimromav," which are the words that everybody knows anyway from the sentence, then I think that's a beautiful read. God is making peace in the heavens up among the celestial bodies. The problem I have, first of all, is that it doesn't fit the first half of the sentence at all. However you read the first half of the sentence. Dominion and dread are with him. This is not the act of dominion. This is not the act of dread. This is the act of a kind and understanding entity who's going to, make nice to everybody.
Unless it's super cynical, dominion and dread are, he emanates, exerts dread and dominance. At the same time, he's having a good time of it. He is enjoying himself upstairs.
Nah. It's not Bildad type of a speech, then. Yeah. I mean, it really doesn't fit Bildad. The other problem I have is it doesn't fit with the next sentence, because the next sentence speaks of God's great, many servants and his vision being everywhere upon everyone beyond the heavens. If the peace he makes is just in the heavens, then what are we doing in the next sentence? Which you could resolve, but I'm just pointing out that it presents a challenge. So there's Ibn Ezra's view. Ibn Ezra is source number 3. And he says, HaMemshala veHapachad imo, dominion and dread are before him. Dread is so much better than intimidation. The more I read it, the more I like it. Dominion and dread are before him. Umimenu oseh shalom bimromav she'en bahem milchama eshen eset. And that's why there's peace. Because everybody is really scared. I shouldn't say that just yet. He says that's why there is no war based on this power that he exerts. Kikulam tov, because they're all good. Vahara hu b'mata la'aretz. Where is there something that is evil? Where is there something that is bad? Only on the earth below. In other words, Ibn Ezra says the message of the sentence is there is peace in God's realm. It is where God controls. Whether he's saying it's intimidated or not, I'm not sure. But he says there is peace up there. Evil is found only among people down here on earth. That's what he's trying to say. Oseh shalom bimromav. He makes peace up there, not here. Ibn Ezra himself, though, is not certain about this, and he concludes, Ve'ela hadvarim tzrichin perush. This requires some explanation. Meaning, it's not clear at all what that has to do with Bildad's speech. You wouldn't think it would be so hard. He's got 5 sentences to work with. And not only that, but what he's saying here are words that we're so familiar with. But again, it doesn't seem to fit. It doesn't seem to fit the control and intimidation and dread of the first half of the sentence. It doesn't really seem to be going anywhere. And so I'm actually going to float a different idea. And that is that you have to look at the way Oseh Shalom is used in general in this book, in Job. If you jump back to chapter 5, sentence 24, and if you're using the Tanakh, you want page 1627. Chapter 5, sentence 24. If you forget which reference, I put it on your sheet. It's source number 4 is the reference I wanted to show you. You see that sentence? This is Eliphaz's promise to Job about what will happen if he repents and returns to God and appeals to God for help. And he says, among other things, sentence 24, V'yadata ki shalom ahalecha. You will know that your tent is at peace. Right? You will know that your tent is at peace. That's the way they translate it here. Keep that in mind while we look at one other verse, chapter 21, sentence 9. When is the peace of his tent if he returns to God? The other one, a more recent sentence, it's found on page 1647. And this was Job's response to Tzofar. And he says, he's talking here about wicked people and how they're doing just fine. And he says, Batehem shalom mipachad. Their house is at peace from fear. They have no fear. V'lo shevet alokaleihem, God's rod is not raised up against them. What kind of peace are we talking about in these two references? What Eliphaz promised, that you will know peace in your tent, and the statement here of the house having peace and no fear. What kind of peace is this?
Domestic?
I don't think so. It does mention houses, but it's not domestic. It's,
not because there's peace, but because you were afraid of God and you repented, and therefore you got peace.
Well, no. Job is talking about wicked people not being afraid of God.
And
yeah, and yet they're at peace.
Literally, shalim.
So peace isn't positive, it's negative.
Well, the question is, what is it? What does it mean? Shalom and shalem are linked, that's true, but
they're complete.
They're not afraid of anything, precisely. It's not peace, it's security. That's the key. It's, we are not afraid of being attacked. In Eliphaz's speech, he said, if you come back to God, you won't fear any attacks from elsewhere. You'll know that your tent is fine, everybody is safe at home. It's safety. And here, Job says, the wicked people are living with security. They're safe. And so what I would suggest is that what he's saying here is, Hamshel vafachad imo, God has dominion, and everything dreads God. And therefore, oseh shalom bimromav, therefore there is security. Therefore there is safety up there. In other words, no one can attack. Because God is mighty, He is safe and secure, and He creates safety and security in His heavens. As opposed to the next sentence, where he says, Hayesh mispar ligdudav, is there any number to his servants? His servants are infinite, and he perceives everyone. What he's trying to emphasize here, as I understand it, is simply divine power. That's really what he's saying. That God has the ultimate control over everything, and therefore there is security. There is safety for God. You follow? That's what I'm suggesting is what he's saying here. Oseh shalom bimromav is that God has safety and security up there. That's clearly not the way we use it when we say it in our liturgy. But that's the way I think it means. I think that's what it means in context. Susan?
I'm just a little confused because I thought God being all powerful doesn't need safety and security. It's automatic because He's God. Or He, She, It, whatever.
Yeah.
But the God needs, by God's existence, He is supposed to be, all powerful, all safe. So, does He need that security from the heavens? Isn't it automatically assumed that He has it?
Well, I think what Bildad is doing is he's making a point, which he's building. He hasn't completed it yet. His point is going to be divine superiority over the human being. That's where he's going. And he's beginning by emphasizing the power that's there.
I agree with that God's divine and powerful, but God doesn't need security. God has it. It's just there. It's not a matter of I'm afraid of God, therefore.
What does that mean?
Well, they're afraid of God in the heavens, and therefore there's peace and security for God. But I didn't think.
And for everybody up there, I suppose.
And for everybody. But I just thought God's existence created. He didn't need security because He is, not as opposed to.
No, but I think that's it's not by dint of His existence, it's by dint of His authority. And that's what Bildad is describing. That's the way I look at it. I'm sort of tempted to say Oseh Shalom Bimromav is like Mimromav. He makes peace from his realm and extends it everywhere else. He has all of this power, therefore he extends security forth from it. But it's not what the Hebrew says. It says in his heavens. Yeah. I'd like to, it's just wrong. Elisheva.
Unless this is kind of like an insight into, that Satan is with him all the time, he's got
chill about the emo. He's got all this dread that's hanging around him, but post-national remote, he makes peace in the heavens among those people who are warring to, you know, get him to do his
interesting. I mean, the problem is we haven't seen anybody, you know, make that kind of a reference yet, but yeah.
In order for Hashem to make peace in the heavens, he's making peace because there's strife. And the peace is more powerful. He chooses the peace to be more, to overcome any strife.
Yeah.
And that's what we're to image. Because on Earth, humans have the choice between good and evil, peace and strife. And we have to emulate God and have peace dominate.
That would be nice.
I see.
It would be nice. I'm not sure I see it here, but it would be nice in general. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think, take a look at sentence 4, because you'll see where he goes with it. He says, "Umayitzdak enosh imkel." How will a person be found tzaddik with God? How will a person be found righteous with God? God is so powerful, so dreadful. He makes peace in the heavens. Safety, security, whatever we want to call it. Puny human being, right? Mayitzdak and Oshim Kale. How are you going to be found righteous with God? Umayizke Yilud Isha. One who was born of woman, which is a term that we've seen a couple of times in the book to refer to a human being in his most mortal state. How is he going to find merit before God? Can't be. You don't have that kind of... You're playing at the wrong level, Job. But there's a problem here. Yeah, Rita.
Well, we have read that people do find it. Like when we studied Noah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Noah found merit with God.
Right, so Rita points out, if you look biblically, people do find merit before God and find favor in God's eyes, like Noah, not to mention Job in the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Right? Job is described with great honorifics. He was great. But that's one problem. I have a separate problem which requires that you remember the book, which, you know, fine, that's hard. Go back to chapter 9, sentence 2, please. I referenced it on your sheet in source number 5 with 3 exclamation points. That should tell you there's something up. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1631. Look familiar? You didn't even need to flip the pages to find it. You could have just stayed on your page. Who's speaking there?
Job.
Bildad is now quoting Job. Right? Job said in chapter 9, which I might note was a response to Bildad. This was their dialogue. Right? Bildad made his speech, and Job's very first sentence was, "Amnam yadati hichein, I know what you're saying is true. Umayitzdak enoshim kel. How can man be, as they translated here, righteous with God?" What is this? Why is Bildad quoting Job back to himself? What was Job trying to say back in chapter 9? If you look at the text there, what was Job's point? The key is in understanding one particular word in the sentence. Part of me thinks he's just quoting him back at him because he's run out of things to say and he's just making fun of him. But I think there's something more substantive here.
Saying there's no difference between the good and bad, so like everyone has the same kind of.
Is that what you see in chapter 9 or a general idea?
It says my.
Well, it's my in both places.
Yeah, but in the first one it's like can a person be, can end up.
And in the second one?
Nine, he's saying God's expecting too much. How can you be righteous before God?
Was it?
And here he's responding. Here Bildad is responding to him to humble him.
Take a look closer at chapter 9. I'm going to read out the English here from the Art Scroll version of it. He says, "Truly I know that it is so. How can man be righteous with God? If he would want to contend with him, he would not reply even once in a thousand. He, God, is wise of heart and immensely strong. Whoever stubbornly opposed him and remained whole. It is he who uproots mountains and people do not know when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth from its place and its pillars tremble, who gives the command to the sun, it does not shine, seals up the stars." These are statements about divine might, divine strength. How does a statement about divine power prove that I can't be found righteous before God? The two don't have anything to do with each other. So God is really strong. He can shake mountains. That means I can't be righteous? No, that equation doesn't work. That's not what he's saying. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 6. What do you mean? You mean in the two chapters, Art Scroll translates it differently? That's interesting.
Yeah. One is before God, and one is with God.
That's interesting. I wonder why. I wonder what they were doing. All right, now you have to explain why. You found the contradiction. Now you have to find out what's going on here. But take a look at source number 6. Not Mikra's commentary. He says, the problem is the word tzaddik. The word tzaddik does not have to mean righteous. What is the other meaning you can give for being tzaddik? Innocent. As in a trial, when you win. To be found righteous doesn't mean righteous, it means victorious. To be the one who won the trial. To be tzaddik, exactly.
You're right. Yeah.
And so what he's saying is, the way Job uses the sentence, and we'll see it in Dot Mikra in a second. The way Job uses it is he says, who can win with God? I want to litigate against God, but I can't win because God moves mountains and he doesn't listen. He just is all powerful and he's not paying attention to me. He's not listening to what I have to say. That was what Job said back in chapter 9. Bildad spits Job's words back to him, saying not no one can win against God, but no one can be found innocent with God. Take a look now at the Dan Mikra. He says, Yitzdak bit tzaddik, yetze tzaddik berivom Elokim, to emerge as tzaddik from his quarrel with God. Umashmauto kfula, it is a double meaning. Yetze zakai bidino, to emerge innocent in his judgment, meaning to win the case. I'm sorry, to emerge innocent in his judgment means to be judged and found innocent. Yetze menatzeach berivo, as opposed to emerge victorious in his judgment, that you won the case. So what Bildad is doing here is he's absolutely, I think there is an element of mockery of Job. I'm going to use your own words against you. But what he's trying to say to him is, you can't be found innocent before God. There is no way that you're going to be found innocent before God. It's just not possible. He sees everything. Everything is at his disposal. He can see everything. He can know everything. He can reach everything. I'm still a little bit stuck with sentence 2, which is a reference to how he employs his power. But what he's saying here in sentence 4 is, Ma yitzdak enoshim kel. How can somebody be found righteous? Meaning, you can't. You're not going to be found righteous before God, with God before God. Uma yizke yelud isha. The man who is born of woman, how in the world can he be found zakai? How can he be found innocent? And he has a couple more sentences to go with this, Susan.
No, but I had asked you, in the bottom here, I have a look, it's for verse 25:2.
Yeah.
Where it says, despite God's absolute power. That's what I was trying to say. He is going to be despite.
And interesting.
That explains, like, despite God's power, there is, you know.
Yeah.
That's sort of what
it's a nice idea.
I don't know if there is the word despite actually in there, but
there isn't. There's no subjunctive or anything there. There's no. We just get two halves of a sentence. At the same time, I think it's an interesting idea. Hein ad yareach, he says in sentence 5. I mean, yes, it certainly makes me happier to see it. I'm not sure how it fits, but sentence 5, he says, Hein ad yareach velo yahil. Now, the word Yahil is a trick word. We think of Yahil, we think Ohel, tent. But it's not. It's actually to illuminate and to shine. And the various commentators point to verses like this, one in Yeshaya and Isaiah, for example. Even to the point of the moon, it will not shine. Compared to God, the moon is not shining forth. The kochavim lo zaku beinav. The stars are not innocent in God's eyes, let alone the human being. The human being doesn't rank, you know, in the heavens, such that he should think that God is going to find him innocent. And this is something we've seen before. This sort of what's called, you know, as a logical argument, is called a kal vachomer, right? Where you point out one thing and you say, this isn't true, how much more so this wouldn't be true? So we saw that earlier, Eliphaz did it. Eliphaz said, we talked about how the angels aren't righteous in God's eyes. So too, you know, how much more so, I should say, the human being will not be found righteous there. I found it interesting that he chose the moon and the stars. He didn't go for the sun. Right? I would have gone for the sun. Why do you mention the moon? I thought maybe it's a response to Job. Because in Job, in chapter 9, sentence 7, describes God telling the sun not to shine. When he's talking about divine power, he says God tells the sun, and the sun is silent. So Bildad is saying, yeah, and the same thing is true for the moon and the stars. Maybe that's what he's doing. But in any case, what Bildad is saying is, even the moon and the stars can't be innocent in God's eyes. And he concludes, Av ki enosh rima uven adam tole'a. You're talking people. People are worms. Ben Adam, the son of man, for those who didn't like that it called him Yilud Isha before, now he's Ben Adam, the Tole'a is a worm. And that's it. Bildad's done. He said what he needed to say. Now, I don't know how this sums up, you know, the various arguments we've seen. Meaning we've seen all sorts of arguments about divine justice being potentially subtle, or maybe happening generations later. We've had all sorts of arguments. I don't see it embedded here. You know?
I'm really disturbed by this thing. How can one born of woman be considered pure? Because that's like an innate evil.
Build out his castle.
For sure.
That's their fans. They're finished. Let's go on.
Well, he's not necessarily saying it from birth, even though I understand when you say Yilud Isha and Ben Adam, it sounds like he's saying it's from the womb, you know, from the very beginning. Yeah.
Well, a non-divine being, why has the origin in another human being?
Yeah, that would be the other way to read it. Is that
a carbon-based being?
Right. Well, no. You could, I suppose, read it and say, why is he invoking birth? It must be that it's congenital. But I don't think it has to be. I think it's possible also to read it as, this is a human being. Human beings, they have no shot at being found innocent in God's eyes. There's just no way, shape, or form that human beings can reach that point. To my mind, what he's doing is not a summary, but rather, he's responding to Job. Job said in chapter 23, God will find me to be just. God knows that I am right. He tested me and he found me to be pure as gold. And Bildad is saying, who are you kidding? The moon isn't righteous in God's eyes. Why do you think that you're going to be righteous in God's eyes? You don't have a shot. That's what Bildad fundamentally is saying to him. And that's the last gasp of the visitors. Essentially, when all the logic is done, and all the arguments from our experience, and what we've seen and heard, and visions and whatnot, and parables, when you throw all of those away, at the end of the day, God is perfect, you're not, deal with it. That's essentially what Bildad is saying.
So all of that is basically putting Job in his place. But what does that have to do with God makes peace in his hands?
So I take that statement of Oseh Shalom Bimromav to be not a statement about peace, but rather that there is no threat to him. Oseh Shalom, there's security there because of the might that is with him.
Suggestion of a threat to God.
Right.
Unless he's making a distinction between mortals cannot be pure, but up in heaven there's a chance.
And that's one way that it could be read. That's Rashi's approach. Ibn Ezra's approach. that they're good up there. And even still, they still don't match God. Even still, God still doesn't find them pure. And it's a possibility. I leave sentence two as a problem. I don't really know how to make myself comfortable with that. The problem, though, with Bildad is that his point is irrelevant. Is Job going to care about what Bildad just said? Why won't Job care? Does it have anything to do with Job's point at all? Job's point was, I am suffering unjustly. You may tell me that I'm wrong when I say God is going to find me innocent. But you can't possibly tell me that I deserve what's happening to me. Take a look at that Mikra's comment. I brought it in source number 7. In his summary of this chapter, he writes, etc. Job accepts Bildad's principle of dominion and intimidation are with him. Job did a better job than Bildad in describing how powerful God is, and he's going to do it again in the next chapter. Spoiler alert. But he says, "Aval eino mode b'maskana shelo." He doesn't accept the conclusion. Kafisha Bildad mevinota, as Bildad understands it. Umay yitzdak en oshim kale. How will man be tzaddik with God? That Job doesn't accept, because Job's protest is fundamentally, "You're right. God is powerful. That doesn't mean that I'm not good, and it certainly doesn't mean that I deserve what has happened to me." And therefore, you know, Bildad is all well and good, but I'm not going to accept him. You follow? And that brings us to chapter 26. Told you we'd do more than a chapter today. Moish. Yeah.
Don't stop it here. Something more here.
Yeah.
That should be a problem to deal with, which is he's positing a God who has no relationship with humanity and to whom humanity cannot talk.
Who is positing that?
Bildad.
He said that God sees everyone.
But he's simply a being. He's Canada's Wonderland. Yeah. Get on the ride if you want. Or don't get on the ride if you want. But you have no relationship with God. And even more so, you can't talk to God.
Right. It's interesting. You're right. Even though I'm kind of stuck, as he says, God's light stands everywhere, and therefore he gets to see everybody. But it's not a two-way street, and God is not described as interacting on our plane. It's an interesting point, especially because they have made the point previously, they believe that God interacts on our plane. Why is that missing from this conversation?
Sometimes when people speak, they leave their weakest argument for the end. And perhaps he knows, and I only came to this very late, so I don't really know, but knows that there is an answer to what he's saying, and the answer is communicating with God, whether by tefillah or other things. And he's sort of saying to Eob, don't think there's anything out there. I don't know whether Eob will be thinking about this or not, but it's a weak argument, and they're just six stupid because it's a terrible one.
Right. It could be this is just what he had left. It's entirely possible that this is just what he had left, and because he really has, and you're right. This whole section here is, what does God do up there? And he sees down here, but no mention of interaction, which Bildad so clearly believes in. He has God as a manipulator of this world. So maybe he's just sort of petering out at this point. It's a good thought.
To use somebody else's word, in many ways it's a super cynical statement to talk about God in that way.
Could be.
Or it could
be. I mean, I'm not sure, but... Okay. So let's take a look at chapter 26. We're going to start it. In 26, we get Job's response to Bildad. I'm not going to summarize Bildad again because we have summarized him. We summarized him at the beginning of today's class. But what's new here? So there's one piece of this. It's a short chapter as well. It's, you know, all of, what is it, 14 sentences in the chapter. 14 sentences in the chapter. There might be nothing new here. But what we're going to see Job do is to declare that he knows God's strength very well. That might not be new. That might be redundant. We've seen that idea before. But it could be that it goes along with what we saw at the end of chapter 24, where he also took on the speech of his visitors. It could be that's what he's doing here as well. Let's see how it plays out. Vayan iyo vayomar. Job declared and said, Me'azarta lelo choach. How have you helped one who has no strength? Hoshata zero alo oz. You have helped the arm that doesn't have strength. That's one approach to this line. What are you offering me? I am so weak. I'm so debilitated from what has happened to me. What kind of help is this? That's one way to read the line. The other way to read the line is, you have no strength. How have you helped, without any strength, your arm that has no might? Sentence 3, Maya atzta lelo chochma. How have you given counsel for one who has no wisdom? Or, how have you given counsel with no wisdom? Vitushia lorov hodata. And counsel you have given to many. What kind of counsel have you given? Es mihi gadata milin. He says, to whom are you speaking? Vinishmas mi yatz amimeka. And the soul of whom has come out from you. What does that mean? The soul of whom? I understood everything until I got to the end of that sentence. Meaning until now, he's saying, either what kind of advice are you giving? Like, why is this helpful? Or he is saying, worse, you have no strength and you have no wisdom in what you're saying. But what does he mean when he says, the soul of whom, or the breath of whom, has emerged from you? Dead people? Uh-oh. Why would he be accusing him of having dead people speak from him? Oh my. Birth. Maybe. The Da Mikra says it's sarcastic. He's saying the neshama here is a prophecy. And whose prophecy are you channeling that you're trying to offer me? And he's saying it to him sarcastically. I like further Mitzudat David, though. If you flip the page, I still have to come back to sources 8 and 9. We may not get to them today, but I'll show you 10. Mitzudat David says, Nishivata ruach shalmi yatsa mimcha, the blowing of whose wind has emerged from you. Rotzel Omar, Mimi shamata advirim ha'ele. Who'd you hear this from? Ubederech lagamar. He is mocking him. It's an expression of scorn, like, you know, what website did you get that advice from? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. That's what he's saying to him. The, you know, where did you find this stuff? So, yes, Job, you know, we've seen Job be sarcastic before. This isn't surprising. He likes that. And, you know, I can't blame him in his position. But he says, you know, this is really, like, this is your advice? This is how you help somebody? And then, in sentence 5, he starts to talk about divine strength and divine might. And there are a couple of different approaches to this. One approach is sort of a natural approach. One is a supernatural approach. And we'll see how it flows. He says, Harifaim yecholalu mitachas mayim v'shochneihem. He says, the Rifaim yecholalu. Rifaim is a term that you'll find biblically to refer to an ancient race of people. However, it's usually used to refer in Tanakh to the dead. And sometimes even like ghostly dead. Here they translate it as, will the dead spirits who are underneath the water be stirred? And that is taking the approach that Rashi and Mitzudat David take to this line. Harifaim yecholalu. The dead will be stirred, will tremble. Mitachas mayim v'shochneihem. Beneath the water, and as they render it here, beneath the... Hang on, where did I lose it? Beneath the water, or those who dwell there. Now, the Art Scroll takes it a little bit differently than Rashi does. I'm going to stick with Rashi and Mitzudat David as opposed to the way the Art Scroll takes it. The way that Rashi reads it, the way Mitzudat David reads it, is that what he's saying is, yes, God sees everything and establishes everything, and everybody is afraid of God, even the dead in their graves. And if you take a look at source number 11, you see how Metzudat David frames it. He says, "Hinei haGehinom mekom haMeisim asher yesh ba chalalim rabim." He says, "Gehenim is the place of the dead, with many spaces in it, or many corpses, depending on how you translate the word chalalim." "Vehem shiva medurei Gehinom." These are the seven levels of Gehinom. "Vehu mitachas haMayim." And that is beneath the water. "Vashochnim bahem." And those who dwell in the water. Because the Talmud has a discussion about where the entrances are to Gehenim. If you want to know how to get there, read that passage. But one of the entrances is in the sea. So he's saying that the entrance is below the sea, and the dead who are there tremble from God. That's how great God is, Job is saying. He's so powerful that the dead there are, even they are afraid. That's one approach. Ralbag takes a more natural approach to this, rather than the supernatural, and I brought it for you in source number 12. He says, you want to know who the dead are that are in the earth and below the water? Seeds. It's talking about seeds, that plant that you plant and that grow. And yecholalu can also mean to be born. It doesn't have to refer to trembling. And so he says, Haim in source 12, Haim garinei hazera, this refers to seeds. Ukra'am rifa'im, and he calls them rifa'im, which I rendered here as ghosts. Lihyosam kodem hazriya kemesim, because before they're planted, they're dead. V'imatzelem koach nafshi kishen izra'u, but they have a life force when they are planted. V'ze pele gadol, and this is an amazing thing. And he said this of the plants that grow in the seabed and in the riverbed, and what it's talking about is not them trembling and fear of God, but rather that God sees the seeds that are beneath the water that are going to grow, and nothing is hidden from God. Even those are visible to God, as he continues in Pasuk Vav in sentence 6, when he says, Arom Sheol Negdo, the Sheol, the grave, the depths, are unclothed before him. Ve'en ksus la'avadon, there is no cover for Avadon, for the destruction in the end, for death, for the grave, there is no concealing it. Everything is visible before God. Job is saying, God sees all. Which, again, is what Bildad said. It's exactly what Bildad said. And he's going to continue with it. He's not done. I'm racing against the clock here, and I will lose. But the message that he's trying to give is God sees everything. And the question we have to ask is, what is he trying to accomplish by saying this? Why does Job think he's serving his cause by emerging with these words? So one approach is Ralbag's approach in source number 8. We'll read them next time, but I just want to explain a little bit. Ralbag is saying that Job doesn't want to go into an at-length answer. He's already dealt with this point about divine might, and frankly, he's tired of it. It's redundant. So instead, he says, I'll talk to you about divine might. I'll talk to you about divine might. I recognize God's power. It has nothing to do with my point. That's Ralbag's approach. Newsom argues that this is what we already saw before. This is Job, again, taking what the other has said and inserting it into his own, confusing him by presenting this apparent contradiction, which to Job is no contradiction in this case, because Job believes in divine might. That wasn't his point. But he's just doing it to fluster Bildad. There's more to be said, and we'll have to come back to it, God willing, next week. Chag Urim Sameach, and we'll meet again, God willing.